This is the I Read Comic Books Podcast. This week's episode is recorded on March 6, 2016. On this week's episode, Tia Vasiliou and Brian Murray join me, Mike Rappin, to chat about comic book costumes. We dive into cosplayability, iconic costumes, and movie and TV adaptations of superhero costumes. This week goes off the edge for the rails, and I apologize. And now, this week's episode... off the edge with the rails at the end, and I apologize. You got the hot take, you know? Don't use that. This is the I Read Comic Books Podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week are two fantastic people, Brian Murray.
Hello.
And Tia Vasiliou.
Hello.
Thank you both for joining me this week. I'm so excited that you're here. And in fact, I'm so excited to talk about comics. So I have to ask you the question I ask every week. How are you and how are comics? How have they been?
Comics have been awesome.
It's good to hear.
Yeah,
Go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say that my comics have also been good, but I haven't been able to read many of them.
Oh, yeah. What have you guys been reading this week?
Well, do we want to gush about how awesome Black Widow was now, or do we want to save that for the end of our discussion?
did we all read it this week?
No, I wasn't able to get to the comic shop this week, so I haven't picked it
okay.
up.
Okay, well, T and I will gush at the end here just for a moment. We won't spoil anything, but we will gush for a moment. But Brian, then, if you weren't able to get to the shop, what else did you actually read this week?
I got caught up on Web Warriors. It's that Spider-Verse team book that I've been reading. That's getting really cool. They're in, like, steampunk spider world now.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, it's Spider-Man and vaguely Victorian steampunk New York. It's a lot of fun. I like the Spider-People books, like Spider-Gwen, the new Miles Morales Spider-Man that's coming out, I've been reading. The one issue that I've seen of it. I also really like team books, just because I like watching different heroes interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of gives me a good mix of the two things I like.
Gotcha. So remind me again, who all is on this book? Like, or who all is in this book, I should say.
Character-wise?
Yeah, character-wise, sorry.
Yeah, it's Billy Braddock, I think is his name. He's the UK Spider-Man.
Okay.
He's kind of the team leader. But then we've got the Spider-Man from India, whose name escapes me right now. It's Pavitr or something like that. Spider-Ham is on the team.
Okay.
I just love Spider-Ham conceptually. I don't care what he does in the books. He just is awesome for existing.
He does bring some good lighthearted relief to the Web Warriors series. Not that it's terribly dark. It is still a Spider-Man type book. But we've got... Gwen Stacy, Spider-Gwen, is on the team. Mayday Parker is there.
Mm-hmm.
Spider-Man Noir is on the team. So I guess
so
it is...
Oh, so he's like the big brooding Batman type?
Yeah, like it is a little bit darker than your average Spider-Man book, just because he's there, you know, like waving around a pistol and things.
Yeah.
But it's their team of spider people versus the Electros from all over the multiverse.
Oh, I love that idea. Okay, that's great. Like, for some reason, all I can think of is Harry and the Potters and Draco and the Malfoys, if you've ever listened to that music. I don't know why. That's what it seems like to me, though.
I can't say that I have.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They should do a musical issue.
Yeah,
Spider-Man musical. That's a great idea.
It'll only be in production for, like, 3 years, and then, like, three people will die. So, you know,
oh,
no big deal.
Marvel, call us. We have great ideas.
Yeah.
If there's anybody you're looking to get rid of, anyways.
Yeah. So outside of that book, what else did you read this week?
I picked up the first volume of the new Constantine the Hellblazer that's coming out.
I'm so excited to hear that.
I'm not totally sold on it.
You're wrong, though.
I mean, it's... I don't know. Maybe I was just in a weird mood when I was reading it, but... I just wasn't grabbed by it. And I was like, nah, somebody's killing ghosts. Like, it seemed like an episode of Supernatural, which is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
I do still watch that show, even after
all
these years.
Good for you. That is dedication.
Well, you know, I commit to the bad choices that I make.
Yeah, for 11 seasons.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking to the guy who read all the Twilight books because my high school girlfriend made me read the first one. And, well, I had to know how they ended.
Hey, I read all the Twilight books, and I could launch into a dissertation about how Bella Swan is actually a feminist character. Thank you very much. So, we'll talk after the show.
We'll have that conversation later. Yeah, I look forward to that. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe if I pick it up and reread it, maybe I'll get more out of it. But I don't feel that I need to go pick this up, I have to keep reading this, feeling that I get from a lot of other comic books.
Gotcha. Maybe I'm just jaded. For some reason, I'm just taken by John Constantine. So, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I love him as a character. I was one of the eight mm-hmm. people who actually watched that show when it was coming out.
Yeah. Gotcha. Well, Tia, what did you read this week?
Outside of
Black Widow.
Yes, I'll save Black Widow for last so we can segue into yours.
Totally.
I read Vampirella number one, which is the new kind of reboot of Vampirella that is happening along with Red Sonja. And I think Deja Thoris is also part of that. It's sort of being directed by Gail Simone. And the Vampirella book is being written by Kate Leth. And it was Ooh. Pretty charming.
I said woohoo.
Oh, yes, indeed. Woohoo. This one is pretty cool. I know from social media that Kate Leth recently moved to Los Angeles, and mm-hmm. I hope that her move to Los Angeles went more smoothly than Vampirella's recent move to Los Angeles, which you see in this first book. She moves there, and on her first night in her new spooky house, she is attacked by these thugs, and there's a video of it that's leaked all over social media, and everyone's freaking out about her, like, thong cutout bathing suit thingy that she wears for reasons.
Yeah.
And by the end of the book, she's got an agent and a plan and a new outfit that actually covers her butt cheeks. Woohoo. And it's a nice book that I think just sets up this new direction that they're taking the character and justifies her new outfit. And it was a lot of fun, a lot of cool little jokes that you would expect from Kate Leth, and really nice read. And I also read Mercury Heat number 8. This is the second book in the new arc. And I don't know if you guys are reading this. I really wish that you would, just because it's so good. And
this is the Avatar book that you keep trying to push on me. And I'm not necessarily like directly resisting, but Avatar books are just like, horrifying. They're very, very hit or miss.
I mean, I am not Avatar's audience, like, at all. They're violent mm-hmm. and they're sexist, and there's all sorts of problems with them. And what I liked about this issue in particular was it kind of was making fun of that a little bit. It's a sort of surprise crossover, only it handles a kind of, I don't want to say it's not censoring, but it's just kind of protecting the reader from the kind of ultra horrific violence that happens in Crossed in a really funny, clever way. So if that's a book that you tend to avoid, which I do, This is a nice read, because it sort of just makes you feel not alone, and it's funny, which it helps in the sort of critique of it, I think.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Okay, maybe I will sit down and I will read the first trade. I mean, I say that a lot about a lot of books. Like, I still haven't read Batman, and I don't think, you know, who knows, but maybe this one. I don't know, in a moment I will talk about all of the crazy things that I sat down and read this week, so I could go into it a little more. But anyways, Black Widow.
Oh, yes,
please talk to me about Black Widow.
You know, so as soon as I read it, I tweeted, "Who needs a Black Widow movie?" Because it felt like such a cinematic book to me. And some of the creators immediately tweeted back, "No, we still want a Black Widow movie, but thanks." So good to know that even the Black Widow book creators are like rattling their sabers for the Black Widow movie. But, you know, we'll probably not get one. So in the meantime, this is a pretty good alternative, especially if you read it in guided view. It feels like a movie.
Yeah, I actually did grab this one in digital format, and I read it in the Comixology guided view, and it felt very cinematic. Like, from beginning to end. It was straight up action packed, just what I want out of a Black Widow book, where she's on the run because of something and the government's after her. And it felt like a skip. Like I said in my notes here, it's like it's a skip away from the Edmondson and Noto run where you got more of a personal feel for the character.
Yeah.
But I think having read that book, I don't need another reintroduction to this character. I just wanted more Black Widow story. And I think that's what this book is doing.
Having said that, I think that it's very clear, even from this like extended action scene, that whatever is happening is intensely personal.
Oh, totally. And we got a little bit of feature of Maria Hill, who is probably my favorite like authority figure in all of Marvel Comics. I hope that she's in this book more. That's the one thing if I could ask for this book, I would just want more Maria Hill. But
I could get behind that. I also hope that there's some like Hawkeye and Bucky appearances as well.
Yeah. We just want all of our favorite characters to show up in this book at this point. And I'm okay with that. If they did, that would be great.
They all have a reason to be hanging out with Natasha, so... Oh,
totally, totally. But, so I'm thinking, this book... The one thing that I really was impressed by with this book was that... And in the letters, they said that Chris Samnee is actually writing the story and Mark Waid is doing the quote-unquote finishing touches, meaning that the collaboration level on this book is... Like, it seems like they just put Mark Waid as the quote-unquote writer... Because they needed to get a bigger name, I guess, attached to the book to sell it. But the fact that Samnee's doing this is like super impressive to me, because I think that writing and drawing a comic book on a month-to-month basis for the big two has got to be just terribly stressful.
Oh, yeah.
But knowing the Marvel method of, you know, we draw the art, then we fit the dialogue to the page, means that this book is going to be better crafted than others, where the artist already knows how things are going to be fit together with the dialogue. So in this issue, there wasn't that much dialogue, but on the whole, I think that's going to make a better comic book in the end. So
yeah,
I'm
gonna
super
make
excited
the art,
about this book.
I think that a lot of the storytelling will be done through the art in a way that you don't necessarily always see. And I think that would by it nature cut down on any kind of dragged out exposition-y type scenes that you might get from a book that relies more on dialogue. So yeah, I'm interested to see where it goes in terms of having an artist have such control over the story.
Totally, yeah. But so to move into segue into my reads for this week. So obviously I read Black Widow. I want this book. I want more of this book so bad. I don't need it to be double shipped, but I do want this book to come out regularly all the time. But other than that, I read Saga 34. I actually read that today. Continuing the great saga of Saga. How many more times should people say that? Yeah, and that's totally understandable. I just love this book for the letters and for, I don't know, the story is, it's so fantastic. I don't know, for people that dropped this book after a while, like I could see why you did. Maybe it's stagnated a little bit, but I think we're right back into the fast paced storytelling that people loved from the beginning. But other things that I read Wrestlers in Space number 1, which was a comic that I backed on Kickstarter, and I finally sat down and actually read the comic since I got a copy of it on Comixology. I also had the PDF, but I just never read it. And it was okay. I liked the gimmick of it, but there was, I don't know, there was something weird about it. It took way too long to get into the primary story. And the idea of this book when I backed it on Kickstarter was there are wrestlers and they're in space. And I was like, that's weird and out there, so let's try this. And instead, the book ended up being like this really weird, sexist, cliche-based story. And I don't want to like bad talk this book, but they really could have simplified the origin of their main character and gotten into the goofiness of the book. And instead, they spent way too long trying to build up to this thing that happens to the main character. And then they also had to include aliens into it. And it took way too long to get there. And then there was a backup story that had no explanation. And I really wasn't sure what was happening. So I want to read the next issue to see if maybe I missed something. But I don't know. I was a little disappointed in it. And I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens when you back something on Kickstarter. But it's definitely worth the money that I paid for it. I don't know if I would recommend it to everyone. Like, if you're into weird, like goofy stories, comic books that have bad origin stories, maybe this is your thing. But yeah, not necessarily everyone's cup of tea.
Very diplomatic of you.
Yeah, I'm trying not to be rude, because I mean, if you know, I don't want to dissuade people from reading this comic book, because I think that it has a cool premise. I just think it took a long time to get there, and you know, maybe it has like pilot syndrome in terms of, you know, to put it in TV terms, where the first episode is bad, but everything after that is actually really good. And I think it definitely has that potential. So I definitely want to see where it goes. But the other stuff that I read, I finally sat down and read Skull Kickers Volume 1, which, if you haven't read that book, it's an actual D&D story turned into a comic book without the pen and paper. And like we say this about Rat Queens, you say this about the Dungeons and Dragons comics, but this one actually feels like a game that I would play with people that I know. Like Brian and I have played D&D together for years, and this feels like a game that he and I would play. So it was a totally enjoyable read. I highly recommend it. I think Comixology has a sale right now for Jim Zub. It might not still be going on when this podcast airs, but if it is, go buy all of those volumes because they're pretty cheap and they're loaded with content. But the final thing that I finished this Friday night. It's called Transformers More Than Meets the Eye Volume 1, and I talked about starting this book a while back, but then I only read the zero issue, and I finally read issues 1 through 4, and I am stupidly hooked on this book. I don't know why, but I want to know what happens, and
people
I know...
People are obsessed with this book.
I know. It's a space faring story about people who are stranded, and like they're out trying to find these Knights of Cybertron, and I don't know, like the cast of characters is ridiculous. I already feel the tension and drama between them, and the thing that actually sold me, I tweeted about this when I was reading it, the opening scene to a piece of dialogue was, "He transformed himself to death." How do you not keep reading a Transformers book when you read that? A character literally transformed himself to death, and then I kept going. And it actually is pretty good. So I'm going to definitely pick up the subsequent volumes. I think there's like 6 more, 7 more after volume 1. So I never once in my entire life thought I would be hooked into a Transformers comic. And in college, when I was leading my comic book club, I was not a fan of the idea of Transformers comics, and yet here I am buying into this story. It's so good. It's so good, you guys.
Really drinking Paul's Kool-Aid there.
And I think it started with Transformers versus G.I. Joe, and I don't think Paul reads any other Transformers comics at all, but it's like I had that little bit of like my foot was in the door with Transformers versus G.I. Joe, and now I'm reading More Than Meets the Eye, so here I am. You know, throw your stones upon me. I understand. But anyways, let's move on from that. I feel like I'm getting these internet frowns from Brian and Tia.
We'll shame you about it later.
Yeah, exactly. So let's actually talk about what we're excited for this upcoming week. Brian, your name is Brian.
Wow. Okay.
Sorry. Weeks of habit.
It's so fine.
Brian, what did you read this week?
Well, I already told you what I read this week, but what I'm looking forward to this coming week.
Oh man, I'm all over the place. I'm so sorry. Let me try that again. Brian, what are you excited for this week?
This week, I'm looking forward to Spider-Gwen number 6. I've been a huge fan of Spider-Gwen since it first started coming out, and this, even after the renumbering, it's continued to be really good. We're looking into, you know, we've got S.H.I.E.L.D. getting involved now. We're investigating what really happened to Peter Parker when he became the Lizard. Harry Osborn is on scene now, and he's like a government-sponsored... Or he was in the military, and now he's like gone rogue or something with the Green Goblin getup. And Tony Stark-style empty robots that are fighting with him. And it's just a good wild ride. It's a lot of fun to read.
Yeah, I actually stopped reading this book when they renumbered it. I, for some reason, didn't feel the urge to keep going with it, but you're kind of reselling it. Maybe I'll grab this book and trade.
Yeah, I mean, I personally almost like this stuff after the renumbering more than I like the stuff before the renumbering.
Okay.
Not to say the earlier stuff is bad.
I mean, that universe is incredibly interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And we're seeing Captain America is a woman in this universe, as much like how Spider-Man is a woman, this is kind of like the woman-centric Marvel Universe.
Is it a woman that we know from other books, or is it a new character that they made up for this series?
Is it just like Stefina, like Rogers or something?
No, I don't remember what her name is off the top of my head. I know that it's not like America Chavez, I think, is Captain America or somebody like that. As far as I know, it's a new character, but I could be wrong.
I'm just picturing you sitting over there in your Spider-Gwen hoodie with like all of your spider stuff all around you.
I told you to get those cameras out of my house.
Oh man, that sounds great. Well, I like I said, I think this probably would be a good book to pick up and trade. I really love the idea of that universe of Peter Parker not becoming Spider-Man and Gwen Stacy. Like I really love that character to begin with. So I don't know. I keep asking myself, why did I stop? So maybe I'll have to pick it up and catch up or something. But Tia, what did you read this week?
Well, we did already talk about that, so I'll just go ahead.
Oh my gosh, I'm so bad. You guys, I am
it's
like.
It's okay, Mike. It's all right.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Have you had your three energy drinks by
now? That's right. Have you?
No, I'm only on energy drink number two.
No.
That's my problem.
Oh, okay. That explains it.
Drink some water.
Yeah, Tia, what are you excited for this week? That's what I was trying to ask.
So my pick from last week, Mockingbird number one, got pushed, and so I'm just going to plug that quickly one more time. Pick up Mockingbird number one. And also I'll say that if you're not reading Insects, Insects number four comes out this week, so you have plenty of time to catch up before Wednesday, and you really should, especially if you like I don't know, lesbian Victorian body horror. It's pretty awesome.
Sold.
That is a very specific niche, but I could definitely see a lot of people probably being into that. Like those genres for some reason mash up really well in my head.
It's pretty spectacular, and it's sexy, and there is sex and violence. So, you know, if you're sensitive to those sorts of things, maybe have someone you trust look at it first. But it's done, I think, very tastefully, and Marguerite Bennett writes it, so she's someone that I definitely trust not to be horrible with that content. So it's actually pretty exciting, and I'm really looking forward to seeing where it goes.
Gotcha. Very cool. By the way, I looked up who the Captain America is in the Spider-Gwen universe, and it's Samantha Wilson, who is supposed to be. Yeah. AKA, I don't think it's supposed to be Sam Wilson, as a woman. I think it's supposed to be, like, there is no Sam Wilson, and it's Samantha, it's supposed to be Sam Wilson's daughter. So that's kind of cool.
The connection either way, I think, works.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
I'm pretty sure that she was actually like frozen in ice like Captain America and thawed out later.
Oh, then you're probably right, because you read the comic book. So
I could be misremembering, but
okay.
Well, I'm cool. Pretty sure there's a scene where like she and Peggy Hill, like Steve dies in the Vita Ray chamber or something, and she and Peggy Hill get her in there.
Oh, okay.
Is it? It's not Peggy Hill. That's the King of the Hill wife. That's the wife. Yeah,
you're thinking Peggy Carter. There you go.
Although Peggy Hill is pretty awesome, and I feel like if you put her in the Marvel Universe, she could probably kick some butt.
It was Mike talking about Maria Hill earlier. Yeah, that threw me off.
Too many names, right? Well, good. I'll just move on. I'm excited for, Paul, this week, Paul. what I'm excited for this week is All New Wolverine number 6. I've talked about this book way too much since its release, so I won't go too much further into it, but Tom Taylor, who's writing it, and David Lopez, who's drawing, or who's the artist, primary artist, I guess, this book cannot do any wrong. It's so fantastic. It is the best Wolverine story you could ever read, and it's the best Laura Kinney story and X-23 story you can read. I love this version of X-23 way more than I do the X-23 that's in All New X-Men, because she's actually a sane human being, whereas in All New X-Men, she's just like crazy for the sake of crazy, and I am not a fan of that, because to me that's not X-23. So I have to credit Tom Taylor for doing a fantastic job with this series. This book is one of my favorites. It's one of my must reads, top of my poll type of books that I get every month. So I'm way excited for number 6. But yeah, so if any of you guys are looking for a good Wolverine story, this is the one to read. But yeah, so we're going to take a quick break. And I guess when we come back, we might not come back. Who knows? But when we come back, we're going to talk about, I'm all over the place this week. I'm so sorry.
We're
going
to take a break. Mike's going to have an energy drink. When we come back, it's going to all be fine.
I'm going to take a nap. Yeah. Or something. But yeah, when we come back, we're actually going to talk about character and costume design. And the question I posed was, what makes it good? Who's the best? But we're going to probably dive into a bit more than just that. So we'll be back in just a moment.
So the subject of character or costume design is one that I think about a lot because I cosplay. So a lot of times I'm looking at characters and I'm thinking, how am I going to make that outfit? And Angela was a really big undertaking for me because I had never worked with the materials to make armor before. And I was doing research for months and gathering the materials and I made a lot of the pieces twice because the first time I screwed them up. So I put a lot of work into it. About 3 months into it, Phil Jimenez did the redesign of Angela and she had a completely different costume. And
oh, man.
It actually covered more of her body parts, which would have been cool. But it would have been completely impossible to cosplay. It was just like armor doesn't behave that way. You couldn't have moved in it. So I read an interview with him where he talked about how he didn't take cosplayability into consideration and that he didn't think that was an important thing for artists to think about when they were redesigning characters, which mm-hmm. is such an interesting contrast. And I don't know if Jamie McKelvey necessarily like took this into consideration, but when you think about a character like Captain Marvel, who is so cosplayable and everybody does it, and it actually made that character kind of more prominent in Marvel, they start they started taking a little more consideration of putting her in merchandising and promoting her books and things. So the idea of character redesign and what goes into it and what works in what capacity, that seems like an interesting discussion to me.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, so Jamie McKelvey, he did the most recent redesign of the character, of Captain Marvel, that is?
I think that Chris Anka might have made some tweaks for the latest one that's out now. But taking her from bathing suit and thigh-high boots to flight suit was Jamie McKelvey.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. I wasn't sure about the timeline on that. But yeah, that's really interesting. I think as someone who doesn't really cosplay at all, I am usually just a person that goes to a con, you know, wearing a t-shirt and shorts every year. That's like my go-to getup. I never really considered actually the cosplayability of characters, only because I don't know how prevalent that was, you know, like maybe 30, 40 years ago, of people dressing up as these characters, unless you were, you know, like a hired model to dress up as Cyclops or dress up as Jean Grey. I'm just going to go with those two because it's X-Men. But no, I think nowadays, you know, that's like it's a staple of comic book conventions and just in general. So that's a really interesting take on that. I guess I don't want to like necessarily keep this completely oriented towards cosplay, but do you think that that's something that more and more people are considering when they're doing redesigns of characters nowadays? Or I don't know. I think like if you look at someone like Miss Marvel, maybe for instance, like that getup is so easy to interpret or maybe slightly reinterpret to dress up as. Do you think that that's probably something that's had heavy influence? Or I don't know if you, I mean, you're not necessarily the voice for everything, but as someone who cosplays, maybe you have a stronger opinion than me.
Well, what I think is really nice about the Ms. Marvel design in the first place is that, you know, they thought about what a Muslim teenager would wear. So she looks like a teenager. And, you know, it also, I think, makes it so that Muslim girls who want to cosplay have a character who's a little more covered up, and that and they can comfortably cosplay her and feel like they're, you know, joining in with everybody else. So in terms of, you know, should artists take it into consideration, I'm just going to say, like, it is a really powerful way for fans to support a book or a character that they like. So for an artist to say, oh, I don't care about the cosplayability of my costume, to me, it just gets my hackles up a little bit as a fan.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And even from almost like from a business standpoint, it doesn't make any sense, because cosplay is, if nothing else, great free promotion for your character.
That's yeah, totally exactly. True. Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of characters that I become aware of because I see, you know, like a cosplay blog on Tumblr or something. And I'll go, oh, that character looks awesome. And then I like look them up and find out what they're from and maybe pick up an issue or watch an episode, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know if when Stephanie Hans did her designs for later Angela books, I don't know if she took cosplay into consideration, but I remember when the 1602 Angela came out, like, she was willing to talk to people who asked her questions about, like, oh, you know, what does this look like? Or, you know, pieces of it that weren't actually shown in the cover that was available. You know, she was definitely, like, open and supportive, and she's always really excited when people cosplay characters that she works on. And I think that, you know, when I update my Angela cosplay, I'm probably going to skip the Phil Jimenez one and go to the Stephanie Hans one, just because, A, it's way more beautiful and interesting, and B, I just feel like if that's something that's important to you, then it's not important to me either, I guess.
Right. And, you know, actually, to go off of something you just said, like, so what makes that costume more interesting or more beautiful to you then, to try to segue us, you know, into something else? But what makes that costume good in terms compared to the Jimenez one?
You know, I was just actually rereading the interview where he talks about what he was trying to do. And he talks about how he wanted to give her this white armor because it would make her stand out and it would, you know, be this really kind of ennobling thing. But it ended up actually just being kind of boring. It was literally just like a suit of white armor with her belly showing. And then she has these gigantic wings, and the gigantic wings are cool, but like no con is going to let you walk around with like 12-foot long razor sharp wings. So
right.
It just... And then finally, the point that I made earlier, where it just like it looks really kind of bulky and inelegant in terms of movement, which just doesn't work.
So would
having
you say
never
that,
seen it, it almost sounds like a stormtrooper armor. With
yeah,
a bird
yeah, that's a yeah, good yeah. way to put it. And I think that it was short lived in the Angela Asgard's Assassin book.
Right, and that's probably something that. I mean, do we think that a lot of our artists are trying more nowadays to try to create costumes that are, like, actually usable? Like, in you know, if Angela is, like, it's to me, and having not read any of her books, but she seems like an action-packed style character where she's fighting people. She's not just, you know, being the diplomat. So she's actually got to be able to move around and fight. And I think this goes not just for Angela, but for many, you know, action or based characters. Like, they need to have suits or they need to have costumes that are actually usable and can be moved in without being, you know, fettered by giant wings or, you know, chainmail weighing them down. Do you think that that's something that more artists are trying to design for? Or, I don't know. I can't really say, because I don't really pay attention to that stuff too much.
Well, I do think that artists are thinking about, like, grounding costumes a little bit more in what we would understand as realistic. Like Kevin Watterd recently did the Scarlet Witch redesign, and he's pretty frank about how he just found her old costume just kind of unrealistic and silly. And so he was trying to maintain the idea of the iconic headpiece, for example, but really, like, what would that really be? And so he turned it into like this really cool piece of jewelry that she wears, that like a sort of like a diadem or something. So yeah, I think that as a comic book reader, when I read and see a character dressed in a really silly, outlandish outfit, it pulls me out of the story.
Yeah, do you feel the same way, Brian, or have absolute opposite opinions?
Okay. No, I feel 100% the same way, to the point that it almost makes me angry. when I see a character's costume, and I just think to myself that, like, yeah, 9 times out of 10, these characters are responsible for their own costumes in the story.
Right.
So it just makes you think, you know, like, why would Power Girl take scissors to the front of her outfit
right
before she goes out to fight crime?
Distract, like, them with your boobs.
Yeah, you know, and I can see how that makes sense for a comic book artist who's writing stories for 12-year-old boys. Like, that's definitely going to move comics, but why on earth would a character do that?
Right.
And, like,
this isn't like Invincible, where there's a guy that you go to and he makes your suit for you based on your own specific needs. Like, that's, I mean, that's outside of this, but yeah.
Yeah. But that guy wouldn't put in a boob window either, so.
Right.
You know,
right.
Putting a boob window into a leotard takes some advanced sewing skills with, like, non-standard sewing equipment. So, yeah, like, is that just part of the package when you become super, is you know how to use a serger?
Yes. I'm going to say yes. That is one of Power Girl's many, many powers. But, I mean, but going back to the practicality, I mean, and this is, I think, a topic that a lot of people discuss, practicality versus design. Like, does it look cool versus is it a practical design? I mean, if we go back to the 90s of Marvel Comics in specific, and the Rob Liefeld era of pouches.
Oh, the pouches.
Yeah, and just there's so many pouches. And I only point out Rob Liefeld because he's probably the biggest user of that style, but there have been many other artists. I mean, even Jim Lee's early Batman, or Jim Lee's Batman for a while, Batman had 100 pouches on his belt somehow. And even, you know, the Batman costume alone is something that we could go, is it practical? But it is, but it isn't. We've seen it in movies, and they've played on that joke many, many, many times. But, you know, Batman's suit is an iconic thing. Like, it's that cape and cowl, and it's darkness, and it's supposed to instill fear. And so that's part of his character. And whether or not that's practical, it's, you know, like, from a tactical perspective, it's definitely practical from, like, a psychological perspective. Batman, you know, puts out this dark view. You know, you look at it in a similar sense, like, Cloak and Dagger. I mean, Dagger's outfit aside is ridiculous, but Cloak, he has this gigantic cloak, and that's not necessarily something you can easily move around in, but, like, he is a very daunting figure. Like, if that guy was coming down an alleyway with this giant black cloak, I would run scared, absolutely. So, we also have to take that into account, I guess.
Yeah, but when you talk about the practicality of a costume, it almost always means something different when you're talking about a female character. It's more along the lines of the boob window or
the 6-inch stilettos.
Or the 6-inch stilettos, yeah. Or Vampirilla's, like, weird thong cutout bathing suit thing.
Right.
Like,
right.
That's going to be a front thong situation if you do a front kick to someone's face. Like, that is not staying put unless you have some serious fashion tape in places you don't want to put tape.
Right, right. And so also, with her redesign, her new costume, sorry, you continue your point, I'll ask the question after, I'm sorry.
I was just gonna rant about how I always felt like the thigh highs and metal bikini made it clear about which parts of the woman they felt like they ought to keep safe.
The feet?
Like, boobs and legs.
Oh, okay.
Protect the important parts of the woman.
Yeah, it doesn't matter that her organs are all sitting out in the open.
Right.
As long as the boobs are safe.
Well, didn't Gail Simone make a big joke out of that with her Red Sonja run, where they didn't redesign Red Sonja's look, but there was a practicality thing about why she was dressed that way? Or am I, like, making this up in my head?
No, that's true. And also, she had many outfits throughout the run. So it kind of was like, if she was going to be in a wintry, snowy place, she had, like, furs and warm leathers. And so, yeah, it was a really nice take on Red Sonja, where she just was like, I have many outfits. I dress for the occasion.
Yeah, and in my mind, I always thought that with Red Sonja in specific, she was going for, when she was in that specific outfit, it was like I am a barbarian style, in the same way that Conan the Barbarian is just in, like, a little loincloth. Loincloth, thank you. Where, like, that guy is definitely going to get stabbed to the chest, but the idea is that he's a barbarian, and he only has clothes because they can't show, you know, genitals all over the page. And I felt that was the same way for Red Sonja, and of course it turned into a more sexual thing with her, but at the same time, that's where my mind went with it. So I don't know, maybe I'm just a I don't know, not looking at it from a sexual perspective, right?
I mean, I think that it's all in the handling of the character in the story. And so in someone like Gail Simone's hands, you can absolutely justify it. And I think that also giving her costume changes is another way to justify it.
Right.
So in her new costume design, she wears like a shirt, like an actual shirt, which is great.
Like a regular
person. It says a lot
person.
That we're excited about a shirt.
It's a chainmail shirt, maybe. Yeah.
So, and with that, I guess we're starting to talk about characters and their, I guess, iconic things. And I brought this up earlier. Like, do either of you have any specific characters that you can think of whose costumes are just like great, like outside of their practicality, but you thought like that is a fantastic looking costume because of something?
I think that I remember vividly reading a run on Punisher War Journal that I want to say was written by Matt Fraction.
Oh yeah,
and,
oh yeah.
And he
I know
comes,
exactly what you're talking yeah, about. I'm so excited about this costume right now.
He comes out in this like hybrid Punisher Captain America costume that was just the coolest thing I'd ever seen. I think that is a standout, like that is a spectacular costume moment for me.
Yeah, I absolutely agree right there. That run, this is right after Captain America had died, and Punisher in this run was dead set on being the next Captain America, but he's still the Punisher. So he, and if you haven't read this book, honestly, go back and just read Punisher War Journal from Civil War. Probably some of the best Punisher comics you can read ever. But yeah, the whole point was that, you know, the Punisher was like, I have to be Captain America, but I'm going to do it my own way. So he adapted the Captain America suit. And it's Ariel Olivetti's art. He always draws these big, humongous, beefy, gigantic men. But with the Punisher, it worked so well with that costume. Like all the ripples of armor and muscle. It was so just like masculine.
We need to leave Mike alone with the Punisher for a minute, I think.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm having a moment over here, okay?
No, but it is. It's so good.
Brian, what about you? Do you have any characters that come to mind that are just like, that is so great because of X?
The one that jumps to the top of my mind is actually Iron Man, but not because of any one costume or armor that he wears, mm-hmm. but because there are so many different armors. You know, I love seeing, like, every time Tony Stark puts on a new suit of Iron Man armor, seeing, you know, how does the color scheme work? How is the faceplate designed? So, like, are the eyes the square rectangles, or are they, like, panels? How do we keep this suit of armor looking like a person while also giving it, you know, like, the Hulkbuster massive armor plating and stuff like that? I think it's really fun to see the way that costume changes to suit the needs of the character at the time.
Yeah, I think Iron Man is definitely one of the few characters that gets the most costume changes for that specific reason. Like, depending on the artist, depending on the action, depending on what Iron Man's trying to do in the moment, that costume will change drastically, which has always been a very cool thing about him.
And I know that probably has more to do with the artist than with any, like, in-character reason, but I still just sort of picture off-screen Tony Stark, like, furiously tinkering with his suits to make it adapt to whatever the moment is going to need at the time in the book.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And if I could chime in, I said before, actually, we started recording this segment, that I didn't have a lot of thoughts on costumes, and then apparently I do. But specifically when it comes to the X-Men, so when I'm thinking about costumes and I'm thinking about what is the most defining costumes, or like when I look at this costume, I go, bam, that's definitely this character. The few that come to mind immediately are like Jamie Madrix during the Peter David run that they did right before Civil War started, that ran for, I think, 60 or 70 issues. It was like a 10-year run on X-Factor. It's some of the best X-Men comic books, hands down, which I'll say about almost all of them, so maybe I should stop doing that, but this run was particularly great.
No, I can second that. It's actually really good.
Yeah, and Jamie Madrix's outfit was simply a big leather duster, and he wore a t-shirt or a shirt of some sort that had these, like, green bubbles on them, like just in a line. I think there was like six of them, and they were connected by lines. And it's whenever I see that shirt, all I can think about is Multiple Man, Jamie Madrix. Like, it's such a simple thing, but it's so iconic that, like, there's no one else that could wear that without being Multiple Man. It's always been one of my favorites. And in that same run, Siren had a very, very distinct outfit, and I think a lot of that had to do with her, like, red hair, but, like, the outfit itself had these very nice, like, green, cool green lines on them, and I will always identify that as, like, a throwback to Banshee. So Siren is Banshee's daughter, and so she wore this costume that was, like, a throwback to her father, but at the same time very, like, her own, and I always love that outfit as well. And I mean, I'm going to keep going on X-Men, which is what's going to happen. Rogue, there was at one point Rogue led a team of X-Men, and it was during the Uncanny X-Men run before they renumbered it. She ran a team for about 20 or 30 issues, and she had this beautiful, I don't want to call it a dress, but it definitely wasn't like a skin-tight suit, but it was this really cool jacket-style thing that went all the way up like above her chin. And it had it was all green. It was like the Rogue green color that if you ever see Rogue in any comics, she's always wearing this particular green color, but it was that same color, but it had like this white cross on it. And it wasn't any kind of religious thing, but it was off center. It was just a gorgeous looking coat. And I've never seen anyone cosplay as it, but to me, it's one of my favorite Rogue costumes because it's practical. Like it holds a bunch of, like, not guns, but it held a bunch of stuff in it, and she just looked authoritative in it, and I loved it. Just her look with the hair, with the white streak, like, in her bangs was too fantastic. Rogue has always had some of the best costumes, but that one in particular has always been one of my favorites.
I think that you should cosplay that.
I kid you not. I have talked about doing Gender Bend, Gambit, and Rogue with my girlfriend Kelly multiple times.
Make that happen.
I don't have the dedication. I'm such a lazy cosplayer. I would love to do it, but I don't know if I have the dedication to do it.
Commission the costumes. We can do that
after our after our Gender Bent Daria cosplay.
Oh my god, yes.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. So Brian and I have known each other a very long time, and we at one point a couple years back to go to C2E2, we were talking about doing Gender Bend Daria and Jane from the show Daria on MTV, if you've never seen it.
Oh no, I've seen every single one. I love that show.
Oh yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
That appeals to the lazy cosplayer.
You should get your girlfriend to be Gender Bent Trent.
Yeah, and I think that would just be perfect. But one day. Oh, I'm so tickled by that. I totally absolutely forgot about that, Brian.
I'll have to come up to New York for in October or whenever you have that con.
Yeah, yes, whenever New York's But yeah, so I just want to talk about Armor's costume now because I love Armor as a character, and her costume is like very basic X-Men, but then she turns into this giant robot-esque thing. I don't know. That's so cool to me. But
you have so many feelings about costumes.
I have so many feelings about the X-Men. That's what it comes down to.
That's true.
Yeah, her thing is like summoning like a psychokinetic construct armor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she like has this link to her family's past, and so like she's Japanese, so it's like they played off of like I guess the stereotype of whatever, but I still think it worked out really well. Marjorie Liu did such a good job like giving us some backstory in Astonishing X-Men before that series ended with Armor as a character. Like her dad dies and she's just destroyed by it, and it plays into the whole story. It's so good. Armor, oh man, where is she in the X-Men comics right now? I miss her. I miss that character. But okay, I will stop blathering. This is I have a lot of feelings, I guess.
Mike and the X-Men show.
Yeah.
Oh man. Well, okay, that brings us to TV though. If we're thinking about television and we're looking at like adaptations for TV, I mean, what there's never been a TV adaptation outside of maybe the Flash show in the 90s where you look at a comic book character in the comics and then they pull the costume and put it directly on the screen. And maybe Deadpool. I think Deadpool, the most recent movie, has always been really good.
That's a pretty easy one to lift straight from the pages, though.
Yeah. I mean, it would help if 90% of superhero costumes didn't look stupid when you tried to put them into the real world.
Half of them look stupid in the comics.
Yeah. But like, if you have that costume in a book where everything is also drawn and colored by the same people, it doesn't look nearly as bad as when you put that costume out in the wild.
That's true.
Other real people who are just wearing clothes.
That's right. True. Yes.
But so when we think about them, you know, we look at these adaptations, you know, what shows have been doing it right or what shows have been doing it wrong, or have they made these costumes more impractical, or what does anything come to mind for either of you?
Well, I always felt like the Thor movies really had their work cut out for them because, you know, you want them to look for like Asgardians, right? You don't want them to look like they exist in our world, but at the same time, like, a cape is a pretty hard sell. Like, it's just it can get kind of ridiculous. And
but
yeah,
Loki's costume though.
I mean,
he also had like 4 foot yellow horns.
Yeah. You know, it's a fine line. There's a fine line between stupid and clever.
So
you don't have to tell us that.
I was going to say, I feel like there's some unspoken thing that you're saying about the Thor movie.
Oh, no. Just that those costumes, I think, were probably really difficult to come up with and have them walk that line. And I think that in the first Thor movie, when I can't remember if it's Darcy or Jane asked him, like, is this how you always look? You know, it was sort of like subtly kind of acknowledging that it's sort of purposefully like not supposed to fit in to our normal everyday Earth costume, especially when you get the Avengers all together and like Widow and Hawkeye are, you know, you would believe those outfits as like spy superhero outfits, but people who exist in the world.
Right. I mean, and in their case, I think it's all about tactical, but I mean, when it comes to Thor, didn't he say, like, your magic is our science? So, like, you know, he can do whatever he wants because he's magic science, you know?
Yes. But I do think that it's still, there's still a way that it could have gone a little too campy. And I think that they managed to hold it, like, just the side of the line.
Gotcha. Anything for you, Brian? Any shows that you dig the costume or absolutely hate it?
I think the ongoing Flash series has actually done a really good job of it. It looks a lot like the classic Flash costume, but it's a lot more toned down. You know, it's like a leather instead of a pleather maybe instead of skin tight spandex.
Right.
So they took the concept of the comic book costume and managed to make something real out of it that holds true to the spirit but doesn't look out of place in the real world.
Totally. Yeah, and obviously they toned down the color just a little bit, you know, instead of the
bright red
that's going to blind you.
Yeah, to like a maroon.
Yeah. And it still works. I mean, I can't say I feel the same about the Green Arrow show, seeing that those are the two shows that I like live and die by. The Arrow, I'm not a big fan of the Arrow costume only because it feels less whimsical. And for some reason in my mind, Green Arrow has always been like a whimsical character. And so wearing the, you know, Robin Hood hat, like looking like Robin Hood, but with a mustache or goatee and mustache, like I always expected that. And instead, you know, the Arrow show is more serious and it's military based and all that stuff. But it's not bad. It's just, it's not as exciting.
It's a lot more Green Hawkeye than it is Green Arrow.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
I mean, it's hard. These costume designers, I think, really have a tough job because they are going to catch hell from fans if the costume veers too far outside of what they expect from the comics. But at the same time, you can't take it one for one from the comics. It just is going to be an utterly ridiculous costume if you do that. So thinking through how these things would exist in the real world, that is a challenge, and I commend them all, even if they don't quite hit the mark every time. It's a real challenge for them.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, definitely. The exception being, you know, the X-Men, the original X-Men trilogy, where everyone was in leather all the time. And then the next X-Men First Class book, they put them in the, you know, bright yellow costumes, and it was kind of like awkward almost. Like there was one extreme to the other extreme. And then you look at a character, I mean, of course I'm going to be talking about X-Men, but you look at a character like Emma Frost in the X-Men First Class movie, and you see just how impractical her costume is in the comics when you actually put it on a person. And I have to commend January Jones for being okay with wearing that, even though it was absolutely ridiculous and awful looking for her. But somehow, you know, they made it work, and she was only in the movie for a couple minutes because there were problems with that movie, yeah, despite how much I liked it.
And, you know, I think that if comics are serious about being more diverse and more inclusive and more friendly to women who are interested in becoming comics readers, then they really, the redesign of costumes like that is so crucial because, mm-hmm, you know, I cannot tell you how I felt when I looked at the David Aja Kate Bishop. I just wanted to cry with happiness because she actually looked like a teenager and she had a flat chest, yeah, and she, you know, and it's like, and she, I just, it is really hard to want to like comics and to like pick up a book and the one woman character is just neon sign flashing, this is not for you. And you can, and the way that the women's costumes are, like, that is a big tell. And they just, you know, they have to get it together and redesign these costumes to make them. And it's not even about being practical. Like, they can still be fantastical, but they just need to be more than a sexy pinup girl.
Right. That's what Xenoscope for. Xenoscope is for, right? I mean, and in that idea of redesigning and, you know, recreating characters, or recreating costumes, I should say, you know, when, like, how much of to the original do you need to stick to if you're doing that? Like, you know, Captain Marvel, I think, sticks, you know, in her redesign, sticks very, very closely to the alternate character that she was for a little while in the 90s, whose name is escaping me right now. But where it's a flight suit, but it still has that, like, star symbol in the chest.
Yeah, yeah.
And her character in the 90s that she turned into, I can't remember, this had to do with the Kree. It was a very similar design, but it was more blue and red instead of red and yellow. And I think that that's, like, a cool way to hold on to that, like, original costume, but still evolve the costume. So I guess I'm asking the two of you, like, how much needs to be held on to that character's original design in order for us to still recognize it?
I mean, I think that there's iconic elements that you can take. For example, you can use the color palette, or you can use, like what Kevin Wada did with Scarlet Witch. You could take the shape or the idea of a headpiece, but do something a little more real with it. So, I think if you take a sort of abstract idea of what goes into that character, you can apply it to your redesign. It doesn't necessarily have to be a symbol or a silhouette that you take.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think that the various Spider-Man, Spider-Women, Spider-People are a good example, just because you almost always have that spider emblem on the front of the costume.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you might change the coloration, and you might change the way that symbol is presented. You know, on some characters, it's much more smooth. On others, it's very jagged. But it's always present. And I think that's when that has always held true every time we've seen a new character or a new Spider-Man costume show up. It's always held true to that logo or that emblem.
Do any spider peeps have an actually anatomically correct spider on their costume? Because that makes me crazy.
Not to my knowledge.
They either have six legs or three body parts. It's like, that is not a spider.
I think there was I don't remember what Spider-Man evolution it was, but there was a Spider-Man costume that had all eight legs, and they were like bled down the body, like down the chest of the character. I don't remember what incarnation that was, but I always thought that was really cool, like to take the Spider-Man logo and blow it up and make it like the primary like focus of like, or make it the full focus of the actual chest area. And I for the life of me cannot remember. It's like It looks like a giant Punisher symbol in my head, but it's a Spider-Man symbol.
Sounds like the black suit, the symbiote costume.
That could be it. That could be the symbol that the outfit that I'm thinking of. But yeah, I don't know. I always thought that was really cool. And it's like in speaking of like evolution of costumes, like the one character that I think we're leaving out here is Batman. And I mean Superman to an extent, but I think specifically the Batman logo has evolved so many times, and there are tons of infographics on the internet showing that. And yet Batman as a character has like still remained very, very similar to his original incarnation with the cowl and the, you know, pointy ears and the, you know, white slit eyes. I don't think that character has changed drastically over, I don't know how many years, 80, 90 years, which is insane to me. And yet people are totally okay with that. There have been like subtle variations, but nothing that is drastic. You know, he hasn't got changed into, you know, wearing, well, he has had a metal armor. He's had every kind of outfit, I guess, but it's always looked just like Batman. Nothing like drastically changing is outside of, you know, just the material of the suit, I guess, and maybe the symbol. But
I think that similarly, Spider-Woman's redesign, where they just kind of made her top a moto jacket instead of a bodysuit, and it was still basically the same costume, but that like one change in the way that it would be put together and the materials made a huge difference.
Yeah, for sure. I think that one of the big things with Batman is, like you were talking earlier about the psychological effect that the costume has. I think that Batman in particular is all about instilling a psychological impact in the villains he's going after. And so I think that maintaining that symbolism of the bat, you know, the great symbol of fear, has been very important to the character. And so there's not a whole lot of room for the costume to really change and evolve beyond, you know, adjusting the coloration or adjusting the material the costume is made out of.
Yeah.
I've never understood why Batman is supposed to be scary. Have you ever seen real bats? They're like flying puppies.
They're adorable. I love bats.
Bats are terrifying to me. So I don't know where you're seeing cuteness in this, because they are like awful. See, the thing is, I think it's vampire bats that everyone's scared of, and that's what we think of when we think of the scary type of bat. Not like little baby fur balls with like horrible skin wings. See, even their wings are terrifying. Like that's so, I don't know, like stretched out skin. It's disturbing, because the idea of like a wing being pierced like that just is, ugh, makes me feel all weird and funky.
You know what would be scary is if Batman had a skin cape.
Yeah.
This has been the right. Comic Books awful. Podcast. I have to go and throw up now.
We're gonna laugh about it now, and then later Mike and I are just gonna be sitting in our beds across the country from one another, just like staring up at the ceiling, just thinking about like, what if?
I mean, I guess technically any leather you wear is a skin thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose that's true.
Okay.
I don't really wear leather.
So because Kelly is sitting here and she's listening to me like talk about Spider-Man, she actually found this really cool diagram of all the Spider-Man outfits that have been, you know, over the years. And the one that I was thinking of was from Spectacular Spider-Man in 1996. And the Spider-Man logo is in the middle of his chest, and it actually has 8 legs. And
how many body parts?
2 body parts.
Yay! A real spider! So
it like pinches in the middle, you know, and it's got, you know, I mean, the legs are probably in the wrong place, but nonetheless, it still has 8 legs. And I mean, this is supposed to be a simple logo, so we can't get too anatomically correct. But back to your point about does it have 6 legs or not, it actually has 8 legs. 2 go up over the shoulders and 2 go down the chest, and the spider body, like the abdomen and the head, are right in the center of the chest. It's really, really cool looking. So I'll post a link to that. Not cosplay. Oh, I don't know.
We're not going to get Mike in a spandex.
Yeah, there's way too many cosplay ideas being thrown around to you. You've got to settle on 1, maybe 2, and we'll talk about it, okay?
No, we're just going to knock you out and then dress you up.
Oh, great. Oh, my
goodness.
This
has gone off the rails.
Yeah,
come
this
play
is,
with me, Michael.
This has been the I Read Comic Books Podcast.
I'm not getting asked back.
Yeah.
Well, you, I'm the one who came up with a skin cape.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
If you have thoughts about superhero costumes, or costumes of any sort, you can tell us about it via our new email address, ircb@destroythesaib.org. Also, feel free to follow our new Twitter account for the show, @ircbpodcast. We're still hanging out on Tumblr, @destroythecyborg, and you can post material and questions over on our subreddit, @ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by myself, Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Kruder and Dorfmeister and Infinity Shred. Shoutouts to Potter and Family. No matter what type of podcast you're looking for, you can find it, or something close to it, on Twitter via the #PotterandFamily. Finally, if you like the show, tell someone about it. Rate us online, or write to us. We'd love to hear your thoughts on comics, and we hope your comics are good to you.
You know, I was talking to Nick the other night. We're just going to continue this weirdness for the rest of the show. I was talking to Nick last night, actually, about how our show is marked mature. And I've always wondered, like, you know, outside of swearing, what do we really talk about that's too immature? And, of course, the first thing that came to my head when you said skin cape, and I was thinking about bats, was like a scrotum, but it's stretched out what? And nasty. This is where my mind goes. It's awful. I'm so sorry.
Wait, I'm so.
Yeah, so we already have head. Like an example of what a bat wing looks like. I don't know why you had to go scrotum with it.
So like the cape would be like scrotum skin, or like Batman like has his like scrotum that. Out.
I don't know. You know, I'm not an artist. I just come up with the ideas.
I am so sorry if you're still listening to this.
Yeah, like, usually we don't go this way, but, you know, this week we happen to because I'm all over the place. Oh my God. So sorry. This will probably get cut out anyways. I'll have Xander cut this out.
You know,
it'll be at the end of the show.
Yeah.
Skin cape.
Tweet Irie Complex, #skin cape.
Yeah. I have great ideas. DC, call me.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Somebody asked on Tumblr, and so our friend was asking around work, like, what would be your alternate universe for Marvel or DC? And I came up with this wacky idea where all of the heroes are kitties and puppies, and they're being held in an animal, like a kennel that's run by Dr. Doom, and he keeps adopting them out to supervillains who make them like do humiliating things, like dress them up in little outfits and chase laser pointers, and they like post finds of them all over social media. So they mount an escape with the help from their friend, a mischievous alley cat named Low Kitty. It's genius, right? You would read that comic.
I honestly would read that little comic book, but why Loki? Why Loki? Why Low Kitty?
I'd follow the Tumblr account that posted that webcomic. I don't know if I would buy that comic book.
Well, I don't know. I feel like Low Kitty, because he's like not quite a villain, but he's not quite good. Like, and he's kind of an alley cat. I guess I was thinking of the cat from Coraline.
The cat? I haven't seen that movie.
I haven't either, actually.
Sorry, we're so far off the rails right
now.
Yeah,
this show is over. The show ended minutes ago.
Yeah, okay,
it's
good.
It's fine.